Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fourth Age podcast's continued recap of The Gathering Storm. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with me this episode is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be back as usual. Unfortunately, Spencer couldn't be here with us this episode, but he will be back.
And as the introduction would suggest, we will be continuing our recap of The Gathering Storm. And as such, we will be discussing not just The Gathering Storm, but everything within the Wheel of Time series, and possibly series that branch out and are only tenuously connected with the Wheel of Time at all. So as a result, there will be spoilers. If you do not want to be spoiled about anything, probably want to tune out now.
Yes, we'll try not to spoil anything from other series without giving you fair warning. And the other thing that I want to do before we get started is right off the bat, I want to give thanks and credit to encyclopedia.org. That's encyclopedia-watt.org, because we are using the summaries, the chapter summaries from The Gathering Storm, in order to sort of synopsize what is going on in each chapter before we discuss it. So that's a great website, fantastic place to go and find anything that you need to know about the Wheel of Time books.
Yes, definite thanks. At the time of this particular recording, it possibly should also be noted that DragonMount.com is migrating to a new and improved site, and will be down for just a short period of time, but it should actually be up and running again well before this podcast ever makes it on the air, so.
Yes, and I'm going to actually take a moment to apologize, too, for anybody who has noticed. Again, this will be a gap in time later, but I had several podcasts ready to post, and I have had ongoing computer problems. And then about the time that I got them halfway fixed, it was just not possible to upload the episodes because they were doing the migrations. So I have to take most of the blame. It's my fault. I'm really busy, and I've had really serious computer hardware issues. So I apologize for the extreme lag in posting episodes. You're going to get a whole bunch at once. There's my apology. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Okay, Chapter 8 is entitled Clean Shirts, and it is done primarily from Juan Sanchez's point of view. As she and Lelaine walk through the camp, she notices that the sky is covered with clouds that may or may not bring a storm. There are over 1,000 novices in the camp now, she reflects. Lelaine then asks about the negotiations that are going on, and Juan says that Elida refuses to yield on anything. Lelaine and Ramonda are still jockeying for influence, but Lelaine seems to be winning. Lelaine thinks it is time to send envoys to the nations and wonders if Ramonda will argue with her on that point, since they seem to argue on almost every point. Suan then manipulates Lelaine, saying that she saw Ramonda talking with Maralinda, a distant cousin to House Trakand. Anything to keep her distracted from trying to steal power from Egwene will work for Suan. Lelaine offers to pay off Suan's debt to Gareth Bryn, but Suan declines. Suan then heads for the army camp, thinking that her quest for the Dragon Reborn has consumed her life. Moraine died for it, and she wonders if she should have switched to green like Liana. She reaches Bryn's palisade. It's getting late, and she is supposed to meet Egwene and Teleronriad at dark. In Bryn's tent, they chide each other a bit, then Bryn asks her why she broke her oath. At first she hedges, saying that she had to get information and get Loghain to Saladar. She then breaks down and tells him the truth about the foretelling of the Dragon Reborn and that Tamra was murdered by the Black Aja, and now Moraine is dead too. Bryn tells her that she needs to get to bed. That seems inappropriate to me. Gareth Bryn is aware of her meetings with Egwene every 3 days. She thinks he is insufferable, but beds down with a twisted ring to enter Teleronriad. There is a violent but strangely silent storm in the sky. She moves to the Mistress of Novices' study to wait for Egwene. She wonders if Liana is all right, knowing how spiteful Elida can be. She still feels sorrow at her dead warder, Ulrich. Egwene appears, and they move to the novice dining hall. Suan tells her about Delana and Halima. Egwene brings up Anaya, murdered with Sidene, and Suan tells her it was somehow Halima. Swan tells her about the envoy from the Dragon Reborn, how some Ashaman have bonded sisters, and his offers to let sisters bond Ashaman. The bonded sisters were sent by Elida to destroy the Black Tower, and she also tells Egwene that Sidene is cleansed. Egwene takes the shocks very well, all things considered. Swan tells her of Lelaine and Ramonda's tactics. Egwene is okay with that as well, and they talk of the coming last battle. Elaine has told Egwene of a room where One Tower objects are stored. Swan confirms it is a locked storeroom in the basement, presumably of the White Tower. Egwene says they will meet again in 2 days. Swan wakes on her cot in Bryn's tent. He sleeps on the other side of the tent. She thinks how strange it is that she is falling in love, then goes back to sleep.
This one, I was really happy, definitely during Swan's talk with Lelaine, at how we get to see, and I think they reiterate it, they do that now or in a different chapter, that Swan is really conscious of the fact that everybody thinks that just because her face has changed with her stilling and reinstatement of the One Power, that somehow her mind or her savvy has gone away as well. And, you know, it's really nice that, you know, she's still calculating, she's still manipulative, and she'll do whatever she can to forward Egwene's cause. You know, especially even if it's letting little things slip or, you know, seeming as if she's letting something slip, that'll keep, you know, one or the other focused on other things. And so, I mean, that was really kind of nice. And I don't know if it's just me being a bit of a romantic or something, but there was something really nice about the way that, you know, Swan and Bryn are going back and forth with each other in the tent and everything, and he just kind of casually lets it slip. He's like, yeah, I know you're meeting with Egwene, you know, I don't know how. It obviously has to do with that ring you keep under your pillow, as if I wouldn't notice. And, you know, and it's such a supremely embarrassing event, but at the same time, it's one of those things that's horribly endearing at the same time.
Yeah, I know. They really are getting more and more like an old married couple in a lot of ways. And it seems that that's pretty much an inevitable eventuality. I just hope that, you know, nothing happens that one or the other of them is killed after all they've been through. I mean, especially Swan. I think it would be just too cruel if Bryn was killed and she was left, you know, bereft of him, or even vice versa. I mean, really and truly, he's had his share of heartaches and sorrows, too. He bears it all, you know, with his usual equanimity, but still, you know, you feel bad for the guy. He seems like a really great guy, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, I've always really liked Gareth's character. I also find you know, it's that interesting thing where Egwene, even to this point, is switching locations. Oh, well, the study of the Mistress of Novices might not be safe. You know, if Elida's really searching Teleron Riad, she'll possibly think of going there. And so, you know, they keep this kind of rotation where they're meeting in different spots. And for right now, the novice dining hall seems to be the safest place. And I'm not sure if I'm remembering properly or not. I think Egwene might also have chosen that spot because it was kind of a pleasant thing for her, a pleasant place for her with the various actions that take place in that dining hall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to change sort of topics a little bit here, but one of the things that really struck me in this chapter, apart from the, you know, really endearing byplay between Bryn and Swan, was the mention of in Teleron Riad, there's a violent but strangely silent storm. But we haven't really ever seen much in the way of weather in Teleron Riad. I mean, we see snow on the ground, we see this or that, but I don't ever recall there actually being weather going on, and I'm wondering if this is related to the really odd silver and black clouds that we saw in the prologue and one other time during the books, and what the significance of a storm in Teleron Riad is.
First off, the concept of there being a consistent storm in Teleron Riad, I mean, that shouldn't be possible.
No,
because
no.
Of the fact that Teleron Riad is so shifting.
And that's a very transient event.
The only place, and I don't know if it actually takes place in Teleron Riad, that's taking place, that we've ever seen a weather pattern was in Eye of the World, and I believe a little bit of The Great Hunt, when Ishamiel is bringing Rand and Matt and Perrin into this place, because they're always on the balcony with the strange clouds outside, and that's always one of the first things that's mentioned, is that there's a room with a balcony and these weird striated clouds.
Yeah.
And I'm not certain if that's Ishamiel pulling them into his dream area, because, I mean, we know from Egwene's time with the Aiel Wise Ones that it is certainly possible to enter other people's dreams or to pull people into your own dream, and that the Forsaken really had very little compulsion about doing that at all. They, you know, they would just...
No compunction about doing it anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So I do kind of cloud that. I mean, obviously, I think it's a facet where, since all worlds are connected, the last battle has to happen in all worlds. And again, you're getting that sort of, if it happens everywhere, then there's going to be more fixedness, less mutability within the world of dreams. Because, like, buildings are not likely to change until they're on Riyadh. But buildings are relatively, when you think about it, permanent structures. But, you know, things like doors are really ephemeral, and so they shift back and forth between closed and open, and furniture changes and things like that. So,
right. People are working on shift around or disappear altogether, you know, because they're transient, you know.
I mean, it's also the concept, the storm's silent. It's not fully formed yet. So I don't wonder if maybe it is literally just one of the largest precursors we have to the last battle taking place.
It makes me wonder, what with seeing the silver and black clouds in the real world, you know, with the farmer, was it in Faldea? I don't remember now.
He was...
Rinald, whatever his
name was.
Fonwar.
I don't remember which country he was in, but yeah.
He was in Borderlands. But it was a real storm, and it really happened. He wasn't just going around the bend. It really was there. But it makes me wonder if, along with the ripples in reality, if perhaps there's, you know, perhaps a tearing between the dimensions, that part of, you know, the real world is leaking over into Teleron Riyadh to make this strange storm, or vice versa. You know, I mean, obviously there's some strange dimensional stuff going on. We've got the dead walking, and we've got villages appearing and disappearing that were gone for, you know, hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if this is another manifestation of the tears in reality that are happening. Or the breakdown, I should say, rather than, it may be tearing, but I know it's a breakdown.
Well, it very well could be. The other thing that I was thinking is that, I mean, the storm itself is predominating everything, because through the rest of this book and up to this point, it is overcast. It is cloudy. It is, you know, there isn't a place in the known world of Randland that there's, you know, oh, look, hey, it's a nice, bright, sunny day. I mean, everywhere is overcast. Everyone you encounter in the entire novel is feeling it. You know, it's just this overpresent gloom. And, it, you know, and it is, it's just that kind of, it's the building up, and you're just waiting for the first thunder crack and the first lightning bolt to fall from the sky, which we'll eventually address near the end of the book, because there are shifts and there are changes, and that's, you know, it all ties in possibly as well with that one phrase that we get. I want to say it's either in Lord of Chaos or Shadow Rising or one of those middle books, where the opening lines in the beginning mention that, you know, the dragon is one with the land is one with the dragon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it might be that we know Rand's mood has been going straight down the pit for the last couple of books with no reprieve in sight, you know, at this point. It might be the fact that, you know, because Rand is in such a desperate place and such a drear and seemingly hopeless place, that we get this weather pattern, which is also just oppressive to everyone.
I like that. I like that idea because I mentioned that before, that phrase about the land and the dragon being as one, and there can be no health in the land, you know, et cetera. And it makes me wonder if now that he's had his, you know, breakdown and epiphany on Dragon Mount, if not only will the weather start healing, but the land itself, you know, start, and maybe, well, it seems kind of odd to have the end of the signs of the prophecy of the dead walking and villages and so forth melting away and all these weird things that have been, you know, the ripples in reality. It seems odd to have them troubling the character so and then suddenly go away at this stage in the game. I would think that would be something that would happen after the last battle, but maybe not.
Well, I don't think it's all of them. I mean, I think that there's a very definite possibility that a lot will continue to be wrong. A lot will rest on, number one, Rand's continued state, and number two, on just the general outcomes, because obviously all of reality isn't tied to the dragon. If it were, then, you know, that would really be something that we would have to have a great amount of concern for, because, you know, the world just isn't set up to take the kind of mental abuse that's placed upon it by Rand's state of existence.
I know, and he really has been breaking down badly, so I suppose it's not a surprise that the world is breaking down around him.
Now, correct me, going back to the chapter, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this chapter one of those ones where someone doesn't outright think to herself, how can I be falling in love with him? Isn't this one of those chapters where she's like, nope, 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 it's not love, it's not love? Because isn't it later in the book when she's finally like, oh no, I am in love with him? Oh, man.
Well, I thought so too, but I'm not prepared to go to the back to arguing with Encyclopedia Watt at this point.
That's true.
Without looking it up.
That is true. Is there anything else?
I could go get my book and look.
Actually, I've got it right here, so I might as well. Tipsy Gelding. That's a fun name.
I thought it was odd that she reflected so many times during this chapter about Moraine's death.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, again, a little bit of build on the narrative debt, because we all know that she's not dead, in fact, but that she's the next best thing. missing.
He's out of it. Missing in action, for sure. I think it's really interesting that, you know, Lorraine keeps trying to manipulate Swan, you know, offering to pay off her debt to Bryn and all these other things. It makes me wonder, you know, what she wants out of Swan.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly think that she is somewhat gulled by the typical, you know, oh, well, she's so different now. And she's looking for another, just another pawn. I mean, everything that Lelaine or Ramonda can use in, you know, and getting themselves more power, then, you know, they're going to use it, and they're going to use it very well.
Yeah. One of the things sort of struck me in this chapter is that when they were in Telemundo, or actually Egwene mentions that Elaine had told her of a room where the One Power objects are stored, and Swan confirms that it's a locked storeroom in the basement of the White Tower. I suspect that's foreshadowing for some rather major event, possibly involving that lost male now that is more powerful than Caladon that Lancer mentioned. I keep harping on that because I don't know anybody else that noticed it before I did. I may have done it. Theory board as much as I should, but it struck me after about my eighth reread of the book, it struck me that, oh, wait, what triangle is she talking about? Oh, something missing. And we do know that when Nynaeve and Elaine were searching for the Bow of the Winds, the first place that they ended when they searched with Mead was in a storeroom in the White Tower. So I think that there must be something of great significance there. And I'm going to say it's probably not the Horn Valyr, because I think that perhaps they might have hidden that somewhere else.
I did incidentally find the portion of Chapter 8 where it talks about Simwan's feelings for Bryn, Is there anything else to report, Egwene? Sawan thought idly, rising to change out of her dress behind the screen and put on her sleeping gown. I think I might be in love. Is that remarkable enough? To her, it seemed stranger than the taint being cleansed or a woman channeling Satan.
I know. I thought it was kind of funny, too, that Sawan dumps all this new information on Egwene and she just sort of takes it all in stride.
Yeah. Well, and then we get a flashback to New Spring here right at the very end, too, as well. We know that Sawan and Moraine were such good friends. She's been thinking about Moraine a lot. And they don't really mention it, but during their little chidings back and forth, Sawan had resolved to basically pull a prank on Bryn. And the chapter continues, and it's the very close of the chapter. You know, shaking her head, she tucked the dream Tarangriel back in its hiding place, then snuggled down beneath her blankets. She'd forego the mice just this once. And it just reminded me of in New Spring when, you know, Moraine's doing this entire set of horrible, horrible things to Lon, and at the very end of one of the nights, she's like, I'll forget the bees, or something like that. It was one of those, she makes a determination that she just, you know, maybe I've been too rough on him, maybe I'll let him go this time.
Yeah. And what was with the blue Aja anyway, and those insect weaves? I mean, what was that all about?
I think it's just pest weaves in general. I mean, I don't know.
I don't know. There was something else odd about that. I'm trying to remember where it was. There was a mention of, oh, I know what it was. And I thought this was very odd. I think it was just a mistake. This is totally apropos of nothing, but your pest weave made me think of it. When Egwene first visits Varen in her apartment, the library, there's an owl there, and Varen said he keeps mice down. Well, they've got the whole White Tower warded against mice and rats. What does she need to have an owl to keep the mice down for?
Well, maybe the White Tower has mice, but not rats. Maybe it's a very specific anti-rat weave.
If you have an anti-rat weave, they could do an anti-mouse weave, please.
Well, yes, but I mean, are they using the anti, you know, rat weave specifically because they don't want the Dark One to be able to spy with rats, or are they using, you know, an overall anti rodent weave so that they can be free of rodents? I mean, I don't know. It might have to be specific, and you know, how many weaves can you put in a single place?
Well, any number.
Or it might have just been a slip. I mean,
yeah, I think it might. The slip. No, I don't, because for one thing, that some of these weaves of the Ajahs are passed down from, you know, time immemorial or whatever, and up until just recently, nobody really thought about the Dark One, you know, really using those as spies. I mean, I guess they've been fighting the Blight the whole time, so maybe that's been an issue the whole time. But I always got the impression it was just a general weave against mice and rats, but I could be wrong. Not being of the blue, I could be wrong.
Well, we should probably continue on. Chapter 9, Leaving Maldon, is from Perrin's point of view. It is the day after the Battle of Maldon. Perrin is inspecting wagons in order to keep busy while people stand in a line waiting to address him, or as he sees it, bother him. There are over 100,000 refugees to take care of, Kyrianen and other guys, Shane, taken by the Shaido. Grady and Nayald are too exhausted to make gateways to send them home, and many would not leave Perrin in any case. Urganda wants to leave with Aleandre. Galen wants to attack the retreating Shaido. Even though Fael is now safe, everything still feels wrong to Perrin. Bulwer wants to retrieve some of the captured Wise Ones from the Shanshan in order to question them. He thinks the Shaido were duped by a mysterious individual who gave them objects of the One Power. Perrin sends for Langan, the carpenter, to look at one of the wagons. He sees Fael and some attendants returning to the city. He thinks she is good with people, like Rand and Matt. The next man in line happens to be Tamal Thor, who reports that the Two Rivers men are ready to march, and that some have gone to the aqueduct for fresh water. Tim thinks that Perrin has made the right decision in giving up the Banner of Manethrin. He says Aleandre can swear to Elaine or Rand instead of him. Tim then tells Perrin that most of the Two Rivers men will refuse to go home and will insist on following him instead. Perrin thinks how Aurum died just a day ago, his heart poisoned by Massima. Aravine Carnell is supervising the refugees. She tells Perrin that they are ready to leave. Perrin orders them all to march north. They will march until the Ashaman have recovered sufficiently, and then they will travel either to Kyrian or Andor. Perrin feels hollow now that the anticipation is over, like he did after receiving a Beltane gift from his father as a boy, before apprenticing to Master Luan. He thinks of Rand and sees the swirling colors, then an image of Rand sitting in a stone Tarian home, looking kingly. He can feel Rand pulling at him. In his mind, Rand needs him. That is, he has determined, is going to be his focus now. There are a few points as well at the end of this particular chapter summary. With the mention of the Shaido retreating and Galen wanting to attack them, Sereva, who is now in control of this sect of the Shaido, intends to take them back into the Threefold Land. So this is probably the reason that the Shaido have not mounted a counterattack against Perrin. They also note that Balwer is extremely clever, having already figured out that the Narbaha, or the fool boxes, which were given to, the Shaido, were fakes, but that they were supposed to be objects of the One Power. They also note that he sees Fael and her attendants returning to the city, and there's a question about whether this chapter might not overlap with the prologue, where we see Fael and Shah Fael take out Massima and the rest of his followers, which I honestly probably in my first reading thought as well. And the last thing that they note, which I also would probably have pointed out at this point, is that when we see Rand sitting in a stone Tarian home, that actually places the time of the chapter also back before Rand is attacked at the stone manor house in Tyr. So some of the previous chapters we've seen in this book with Rand are actually happening much later in the timeline than this chapter is currently possessed.
Yeah. I think we're going to see more of that sort of overlap from what I've been hearing in Towers of Midnight. We're probably going to see some overlap with what events have happened in the Gathering Storm. There's just no other way to do it. I mean, it really was intended to be one last book, and it was just so massive it had to be divided into three. So I thought the only way to do it is to have some, you know, almost, not really flashbacks, but things that happened in the last book or concurrent things that happened in this book. So,
yeah, I actually kind of liked this chapter, too, as much as certain parts of it were a little irritating. Perrin has a couple of moments here where he's thinking, and he's like, you know, well, Lord doesn't get underneath the wagon, but I'm going to get under the wagon because I'm not really a Lord, I'm a blacksmith, and it's like...
It drives me crazy.
While I'm kind of wanting to smack Perrin over the head, at the same time, I can understand. I mean, he's just gone through a lot. And we have just gone through a lot with him. And this kind of, he's looking for a way to decompress, but when you are responsible for as many people as you are, you don't have that luxury, ever. You know, I'm kind of minded about during various political debates that were going on around the election of, you know, oh, well, is so-and-so going to be ready for that call at, you know, at 4 a.m. and I'm thinking, yeah, when you're responsible for that many people, you kind of have to be. You know, you have to be available. You know, if it's a servant horribly apologizing to you in the middle of the night for waking you and your lady, because there's an issue, and, you know, the cooks who get up a good, you know, 2 hours before everyone else have discovered that, you know, suddenly all of the flour is invested with weevils. I mean, what are you going to do? You go to the Lord. The Lord is, as Rand kind of muses in The Great Hunt, when he and Huron and Loyal all first get teleported into one of the mirrors of the wheel. You know, the Lord is there because the Lord is always supposed to know what to do. The Lord is the person who's in control. And, you know, people are going to look to him. And he's kind of, Perrin in this is kind of becoming more accustomed to it. And it's just, I think it really is just that it's the Two Rivers stubbornness that he's going to fight it as long as he possibly can before he finally, like the other two boys, just gives in and starts, you know, accepting it, because, you know, Matt's even fighting it a little bit still. Rand, ironically, is the quickest to submit. You know, he kind of drops the pretense of, I'm just a farm boy, years ago.
Yeah.
And,
he'd like to still be the farm boy, but he knows he can't be.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, we get Matt kind of wishing similarly. He's like, I just want to, you know, go and have a drink with my friends and dandle a lass on my knee. Well, maybe not anymore, because I'm married. Although she might not mind. She might be cool with it. You know, I wonder how she's doing.
Open marriage, you know.
I'm not going to turn into a married man. I wonder how she's doing.
Yeah. I feel Matt's so transparent. He's really funny.
Well, and everybody makes fun of him, too.
I know. You know, until Monty's in the last year, and all those guys are always, like, twitting him about this. I love it when that one guy tells him he's a great father, you know, for poor Oliver, you
Oliver.
Know. Yeah. Oh, my God. I thought that was going to send him into an absolute tizzy, but he took it pretty well, considering. I think one thing that kind of, going back to Perrin's attitude toward everything, yes, he is getting more, you know, I mean, he certainly has accepted the responsibility as quickly as either of the other two boys, but he still grouses about it. But I kind of have to throw what Davron Bashir said to him when they first met, you know, boy, you didn't think the Creator made the houses. They're always, you know, men who stepped up and did what needed doing and kept their heads when the crisis came, and, you know, they became the lords and so forth and so on. And he said, there's as many paths up as down, and the ones down are quicker. Only a fool complains about the ones that take him up. You know, it's like, you know, Perrin, like, just, you know, deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, would you rather have it the other way? I mean, you know.
This is weird, because in some ways I do think Perrin would have it the other way. I think Perrin, at this point, and the other thing is Perrin had to leave the Two Rivers. Perrin was becoming complacent as the Lord of Two Rivers, and actually probably would have accepted it rather completely. Each time that Perrin starts getting comfortable, something happens to him, which, you know, reinforces this feeling of, I'm not comfortable, I'm not in the situation where I want to be, why do I have to do this? You know, I'm going to do it because I have to, but I'm going to fight it tooth and nail. And, you know, I think part of that is what is keeping Perrin from just, you know, I mean, the reason Rand has, as ironic as it is, Rand kind of has the most free time out of everybody.
Yeah, it really
and,
is.
You know, and that's why he's able to sit down and go, well, I'm King of Ilion. Ha ha ha. I control nations, you know, and he gets, you know, a big head about it, and he easily transfers into, well, I'm, you know, a lord now, you know, and I think Matt fights it because he has a preconceived notion of what all noble men are like, you know. He even thinks to himself, you know, well, you know, Tolmanis isn't bad for a nobleman.
For a nobleman.
You know, and he doesn't want to become that. And that's, I think that's what keeps him from being like your typical typical nobles that you see within the novels. Similarly, how, you know, Perrin's endless strife seems to be what keeps him from being like your typical nobles.
Yeah, but I think it's funny what Matt thinks about, he avoids nobles He avoids nobles like death, and everything that he thought about noblemen and women went three times for royalty, and then he gets hooked up with first Queen Thailand and then Empress of the Shan nation. It's like, oh my God, Matt, you are so tied to the wheel.
Yeah.
You ain't going nowhere, buddy. You're going nowhere. I just say he hasn't got a clue, but I have to kind of disagree a little bit about Rand. He does seem to have a little bit more free time, but he seems to get pretty stressed out about it too. I mean, he reflects, you know, in earlier books even, how things are spinning out of control, and everything, every time he gets one problem taken care of, two more seem to come up. Egwene has the same reflections, you know, she just wonders when she'll ever get to a spot where she can deal with one problem without two worse ones cropping up to take its place. You know, so they're all sort of stressed out a little bit in that respect, but.
Well, no, I don't discount that they're all stressed, and Rand supremely most so. I just see it more like Perrin, even when he's giving orders as a lord, doesn't want to be giving orders. Mm-hmm. Rand, as soon as he became accustomed to being a lord, was, you're going to do this because I say so, and I carry the authority to say so because I am the Dragon Reborn, King of Ilion, you know, Lost Aiel, Karakarn, Kuramor.
Yeah.
How many different titles do you really want? Lord of the Morning, you know?
Yes, Prince of the Dawn, you know.
It's like, at this point, when he talks, yeah, I mean, when he gives an order, he's expecting it to be obeyed. And
yeah.
Even Matt and Perrin, except in times of combat, don't really do that. They don't have that noble mentality of, well, of course it's going to get done because I said it should get done and I carry authority because I'm a noble.
Well, no, but they don't have the attitude, but Perrin does, you know, right off the beginning when he goes back to the Two Rivers, you know, he starts, you know, ordering the men here and there. He just does it in a nice way because he doesn't think of himself as a big shot, you know. But when he's not thinking of it, he just starts, you know, you go here, and then all of a sudden he realizes, oh my God, I just addressed, you know, Master Althor as Cam and Matt's father, you know, mm-hmm. as Abel instead of Master Coffin. And he starts doing it, and people just obey. He even, you know, gives orders to the warders and stuff like that, and they just go for it. You know, they look at the Aes Sedai and they, yeah, okay, yeah, it's a good idea, let's do it. But he just has the nice attitude, so you don't notice it so much. Matt does the same thing, but he has this sort of laissez-faire attitude to the whole thing. But deep underneath, he still expects to be obeyed. Because all these guys, I think, were basically reincarnations of other important people. And they were all born to this. So it comes out in the most unusual ways. It's just that Matt has this kind of kickback attitude that deep down inside, when he gives the band an order or he gives one of the noblemen an order, he doesn't expect any questions.
Oh, no. I mean, I guess, using the phrase, you know, expecting to be obeyed, it is kind of a misnomer. It is more literally the apparent effect. Like, people obeying orders is nowhere out of the ordinary at all. I mean, you know, Perrin is continually shocked that people do what he says, even though he's younger than them or less experienced than them, or, you know, he's constantly amazed by it. Matt will give, like, and the weirdest thing is that usually Matt only gives orders in battle scenarios. And even when he does it, it is in a very flippant manner, and it's in a way that people can kind of be like, oh, okay, sure. You know, and they're more easy with it. It's just for some reason when Rand is doing it, it has that presentation. Like,
yeah.
Instead of, hey, I'm receiving this, you know, this order from my general, you know, Matt, you know, or I'm receiving this from Lord Aibara, you know, they're rational and they're thought out sequences of obeying the order. With Rand, it carries this sort of weight that the other two just don't ever consciously portray. And it's that kind of weight that I'm attributing to the archetypical ideal of nobility.
Yeah, I have to agree, but I do have to say that I think that probably some of the reason for that is that right off the bat, Rand had it shoved down his throat that he was the Dragon Reborn. I mean, it wasn't very far into the books before he had to accept that. And one big reason he had to accept that is because he could do something that very few people can do, which is channel the One Power.
Yeah.
It's really obvious to him and everyone around him that he has the ability to do things that very few other people can do. And no one with the level of strength that he has. And so, how can he, I mean, like, Karen can deny and Matt can deny and everything like that, but Rand has it in front of him all the time. I'm a channeler. Clearly, I'm the Dragon Reborn. I have to deal with it. The other guys can kind of skive off a little bit and sort of keep more of their personalities, but Rand hasn't had that choice. And he had to deal with it right off the bat. And so now he's had a year or so to be a figure of authority. And even, I think even Egwene, when she sees him again in Kharian after being away from him for a while, notices that he has, you know, the demeanor of a king. You know, he acts like a king. And Elaine, you know, mentions, and several other people notice that, might have been men who reflected that he dominated a room with his presence. You know, even, you know, when he was with the Tyran Lords and stuff like that, he had the inborn nature of a man who, you know, gives an order and expects to be obeyed because that's the way it is.
Yeah.
And he really assumed that mantle pretty quick. Matt, he does keep orders actually all the time in, not in battle. I mean, remember he tells off the guys to go check out the drinking rooms and he, you know, he sends them off on a burial party when they find the tinker wagons. And I mean, he's always telling them, come, go, you know, Espion, go to that ship and get us a rowboat to get it out there. Hurry up. Let's go. Come on, come on, come on. You know, but he doesn't, you know, he still is just like basically a nice guy. He just reminds me of one of the ones that he hates so much, the dilettante nobles, you know, the young, you know, devil-may-care nobles that know they were born to power, they've had power, they have money, they have everything they want to, they don't have to worry about it. But Matt kind of came to it late, so he still has a little bit of appreciation of what it is to be a common man, and he won't let himself be as arrogant and uncaring of people as those nobles that he hates are. But he sure still, you know, assumes that aura of command almost as well as Rand does. Karen probably the least. He's the most diffident of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I still say that I don't know that Matt has discovered that he doesn't really want to go home and milk his dad's cows. Really don't know how happy Karen would be if he had to go back and be, I mean, he could even be so much less than a blacksmith, you know. I mean, what if, you know, fortune took him down to the point where he was like Noel Charon, you know, a broken down, you know, out of work, shiftless guy who basically depended on charity and stuff like that. What if, you know, I mean, he could be so much worse off that even if he himself just went back to the tutors right this minute, after going and doing and seeing the world and actually failing the role of a lord and being married to a lady and so forth, I don't know if he could go back and swing a hammer at a forge for his whole life anymore. I just don't think he'd fit into it forever anymore. But I don't think so.
That's very possible, and I mean, I doubt we're ever going to find out because, you know, at this point, Perrin seems rather destined to be king of Saldia or king of some place.
Yeah.
More than just the King of the Wolves.
Menethrin, perhaps. I don't know. Anyway, anything else in this chapter that you can think of? I thought it was kind of interesting that Thrava is now in charge, and, well, not surprising that Thrava is in charge of the country, but she's right off the bat side, she's taking the Shaido back to the Threefold. That's easy. And someone in a theory, I can't remember who wants to give credit, someone wrote it to us in an email one time, too, speculated that the Shaido might actually be the remnant of the remnant that gets saved, because if they go to the Threefold Land, they may not actually be very involved in the last battle, and they might survive. I really hate that.
Be interesting.
I think that'd be a cheap, but there you go.
I don't know. I mean, that's really interesting. It's definitely possible. I think I remember it being mentioned somewhere before. It might actually have been mentioned in one of our voicemails.
It was either an email or a voicemail. Certainly not original to me. I'm not even thinking about taking any credit for that. Somebody, I read it or someone emailed it or voicemailed it to us.
I'm a little dubious because they keep mentioning consistently in the Perrin chapters that, you know, they keep up this tenseness in the characters about making certain that the Shaito aren't following them, and that they're not going to get attacked by the Shaito. If we take Therava's word at the end of Knife of Dreams, we know she's not going to attack them. We know that she is making directly for the Threefold Land, and that she's not planning on encountering or, you know, doing anything outside of, you know, the strict Aiel guidelines until she gets there. You know, and it's the idea that I'm kind of wondering why we've created this tension for the characters, which almost can't be felt by the readers. It's a random thought, but it seemed really interesting that it's not just in this chapter. If I remember properly, we had, you know, Perrin later down the road, and again, they bring up, you know, a couple of times that they're making certain that, oh, well, maybe this band of Shaita is going to finally attack us, and none of them are at this point. So it's like, without extreme, you know, changes, one has to assume that some of the Wise One Dreamwalkers that were not captured managed to, you know, get the word to the rest of the bands of Shaito that are around that, hey, we're packing it for home. So, I mean, I don't know. It's just something that seemed to spring out at me with the note of, with Encyclopedia Watt noting that the Therava is taking them all back to the Threefold Land.
Yeah. I guess the only other thing that I really want to bring up in this chapter was that, again, we have a narrative debt in that, once again, we see the swirling colors where the boys can view each other. I don't know about you, but this has been mentioned so many times in so many ways, and it's getting so much stronger and more coherent and like that. I'm seriously expecting to see something spectacular come out of this. I want to see instant communication between these three guys in the last battle, or something equally as cool, you know, because I think they owe us.
I don't know. I mean, that's definitely going to be a Raffo, I think.
Yeah, afraid so. Okay, I think that'll wrap up Chapter 9. We'll move on to Chapter 10, which is the last of the Tabak, the last of the Tabak. And this one starts with Rodal Itoralde's point of view. It is nearly 2 weeks since his victory at Darluna, and Itoralde still carries a wrinkled note with instructions from King Al-Salam. Itoralde is now with Rajabi. The last of the Terrabonners have abandoned them at this point. The new Shanchen general has 300,000 men and 200 Jemani, quite a sizable force. They have retreated deep into Eridomon, only to learn that there are 100,000 Aiel north of them. They are holed up in an abandoned steading. Itoralde recalls seeing a master juggler in Camelin entertain the young daughter heir. Just when he seemed ready to drop all the balls, he disappeared in a flash of light and was sitting next to Lord Findal's wife. Itoralde expects his final fall to be as spectacular. A boy brings news that a lone man has arrived, and Itoralde summons his remaining officers, Ankiar, Wakeda, Malarned, and Lidrin. Shimon was killed by a Damani fireball. An escort brings Rand. Rand says Bashir's description of Itoralde's position was accurate. He is boxed in. Itoralde thinks Rand's eyes are like Al-Salam's, reminds him of him. They demand obedience, those eyes. Those cold, hard eyes. Rand says that Al-Salam is in Gwendol's thrall. Rand offers him the Eridomon or the Amadisian throne. He will loan him Aiel and 100 Ashaman stable now that the taint is gone, all Ashaman who can travel. They are to secure the borderlands. In return, Rand will have the Shanshan out of our domain and into Itoralde's control. Itoralde will send some of his officers with Rand, and Itoralde agrees, and Rand orders him to Saldea.
A couple of things to note. The Itoralde's wrinkled note from King Al-Salam is not from Al-Salam at all.
No.
We are fairly certain at this point that it is from Grandal instead. As a matter of fact, this may have been the note that we saw Grandal writing herself in an earlier book.
Yes, that's what I have always thought, speculated on that.
Which is nice, because it was good to when they had that little point of view from Grendel, and it, you know, just noticing that, the tactile sensation of actually writing out a letter is, you know, such a pleasant thing when you do the thing yourself, you know, it was just part of her previous life as an aesthetic kind of bleeding out there, which was nice. It's that, you know.
I thought that was a really endearing scene, if you could speak of the Forsaken in such a manner of, you know, she really enjoyed the artistic ability of forging all these letters and so forth. She reminded me a little bit of Tom Marilyn, you know, she took such pride in her work and doing a really good job that nobody could tell the difference at all without power, you know.
Yeah.
Remember that scene with Tom in the chair where he's forging all these letters and then Moraine interrupts him and he's a little concerned that Chill has seen his box of forgeries, but she's already onto him.
Yeah. I was also impressed in this chapter with Itrolda's recollection of Tom in Camelot.
Yeah.
And just the entire, that, you know, he vaguely even remembers Elaine as a very, very young girl, or perhaps even a baby at this point. And there was something about that juggling scene and just the description of it. And you're wondering to yourself as you're reading, it's like, where is he going with this memory? Because it seems really incongruous. And then there's just that entire idea that, you know, that everything keeps getting more spectacular, more complicated, more, you know, and it's just like, he's convinced at this point that he's going to die. And everybody's going to die with him, and he goes to his troops, and he's like, you know, kind of giving them encouragement and giving them a little bit of false hope, but he's like, you know, I'm going to lead all these men to their deaths. And then, of course, you know, who shows up, but, you know, oh, there's a really odd guy, you know, and he's dressed like a lord, and he's riding up, and he's, you know, oh, look, it's the Dragon Reborn. And, you know, and Rand's offer is just astounding. It's,
oh, no.
He's like, you know, you're going to do this, and you're going to go there, and if you want, I'll give you a crown, you know.
Which one do you want?
Maybe Ardamon. You know, there's Amadisia we got to clean up still, but, you know, I'll give you that one if you want it. And I'm minded a little bit that, you know, Rodel is kind of really, really, you know, almost dog-like loyalty to Ur-Asalam. Ur-Asalam. And, you know, it just, you know, it's like, you've not heard from him or seen him. You know, that you assume the note is from him, but that's, you know, that doesn't mean anything in this world today. You know, and yet you're still gonna, you know, go about this entire, you know, campaign of, you know, just creating turmoil and chaos blindly. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it really does take Rand bending the universe around him to shake Rodel out of it. And, you know, even then, it's not the easiest of things to come to grips with.
No, I think there was a little severe and twisting involved in getting into that. And that whole scene was kind of odd. It just seems so incongruous that Rand is just throwing, you know, thrones around. Of course, he did that with Darlin Cisnera, too. Oh, by the way, you'd be the new king of Tyr. Wait, king, he hasn't had a king in centuries. Wait, what? That's okay, it's you. You're it. Sort of reminds me of that scene in, I'm going to make a crossover we have not made before, okay? Here's a man crossover, Dark Knight. Reminds me of that scene where the mayor talking to Commissioner Gordon, and actually he's talking to Gordon, I don't know what his rank was before that, and he said, well, congratulations, this mayor, you don't have a choice. Oh, by the way, you're the new commissioner, you don't have a choice. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And that usually happens from the register thing, but, you know. I don't know what's going to become of Esmeralda. You think he's actually going to go on to rule in these two cuts?
I don't really know. Rodel seems to be one of those. Unfortunately, we're running out of the great generals of the time. They seem to be slowly dying, one by one.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think at this point we're down to Rodel, Bashar, and Bryn, right? Do we have any of the others left? I guess Aglomar is still alive.
Aglomar, Lord Aglomar is still alive, yeah. As far as we know.
Yeah, so we're down to, just four of them from a score. And I mean, granted, we're cropping up new great generals all the time, but, you know, it seems interesting that, again, we're kind of getting down to the grit here. And when it comes to it, I mean, Rodell's convinced himself that, you know, he's been avoiding the Reaper as long as he possibly can, you know. It may just be foreshadowing that he's, you know, destined to kind of go out, and it might be a grand and, you know, heroic death. And if not, then yeah, he does deserve a crown. But again, he doesn't really want one. And of course, the adage has been brought up multiple times in the series. You know, it's the person who doesn't want it that's the best person for the job. Which is honestly why Perrin makes a great lord. He doesn't want to be a lord. You know, he wants to be a blacksmith. He wants to have a nice, happy, you know, life, and work isn't something he thinks about. It's not, you know, a problem for him if he works. It's not, you know, a grand problem for him if he doesn't. You know, as long as he and his family are safe and happy, he doesn't really care. So it's, you know, one of those, it's like if he does survive, I think Rodell would make an excellent addition to the roster of new kings and queens that are going to have to be set up to replace all of the ones that we have lost and are going to lose.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Well, clearly this is all part of the not physical breaking of the world. You know, he's reordering everything, and it's just odd. I mean, so much is changing so rapidly, you know?
Yeah. Well, I also, they make the mention, you know, that it's fairly obvious that it's some Taveran twisting that gets Rodell to agree. And, you know, he agrees without any proof of Rand channeling, because they're holed up inside of an abandoned steading, so Rand can't channel when he's in there. You know, it really takes some, and I think Rand comments about it, about it's like, well, you, nice choice there. You know, obviously the Damani can't, you know, attack you in here, so. But if you, you want a true demonstration of my power, you're gonna have to step outside.
Well, that's alright, I'll pass.
Well, so we're gonna move on to chapter 11, The Death of Adrin. Avienda is back at the Log Manor. The maidens, including Larian and Suriel, are angry that Rand met with Rodell Itralda alone. They are talking in hand speak, and even though Avienda is not supposed to, she sees it and, you know, translates in her mind what they're talking about, and how Rand is continually dishonoring both himself and the maidens by going into situations and not including them. It's a rather consistent theme. Avienda, while she is doing this, is carrying rocks from the stream to the manor house and then back again as more punishment for not learning as quickly as she should. She is intent on regaining her honor in order to merit Rand as much as Elaine and Min do. Her time with Elaine made her a lot more used to there being a good deal more water here than in the Aiel Waste. Bashir keeps a good camp, but the men move more slowly with the strange dark sky overhead. Two Saldan guards stand at the door to the manor. One of them complains of the heat, though it's not particularly warm. Avienda doesn't understand why he's complaining. She goes on a slight bend of thought, which tends to try to attribute the act of complaining to the gaining of some sort of honor, and does not a very successful experiment, but an amusing one nonetheless. According to her, you know, complaining should be a sign of weakness, yet she, of course, will admit that Elaine complained frequently, particularly during her pregnancy, and she is free to admit that Elaine is in no way, shape, or form weak. Through the bond, she knows that Rand is in his rooms. The Wise Ones continue to question her about Rand and Rark. The next time that she passes the door, the guard, Adrin, looks very, very ill. Suddenly he rakes at his face, and smoking black tarry coals pour out. He collapses, his clothing bursting into flames and setting the doorframe on fire. She weaves air and water in order to extinguish the fire, but her weaves fail as they near the burning mass. She tries to smother the flames then, pulling up earth, using earth and air, but that is not enough. Finally, she thinks to use weaves of air and water to pull a spout from the stream and to continually douse the flame, much like a one-power variant of a fire hose. She sees other streams form. Nafe stands at a window above her, and finally the water douses the fire. Rand appears in the doorway, comes out shaking his fist angrily at the sky, yelling at the Dark One that in his rage. A lanky young Domani officer is shaken by the experience. Bashir begins to restore order among the men. Lord Talen moans about the damage done to his manor. Several Aes Sedai come out. Maurice says it's a shame that Avienda is not in the White Tower with her talent with the weaves. Melanie comes up and stares down Maurice. Melanie then compliments Avienda, saying no Aes Sedai, save perhaps Kaswani, could have done what she did. Melanie then asks her opinion on Rand's plans for the Council of Merchants. Rand's continued demands may alienate the clan chiefs. She says that Rorik is a wise and patient man, but others, such like Timelon, are not. Melanie wonders what remnant of a remnant Rand will leave of the Aiel. Melanie then sends Avienda to bed. She looks like a Shadaran crawling for 3 days. There will be more punishment tomorrow for Avienda's failure to learn quickly enough. And Avienda thinks about going to Rand, but she is determined that she will not until she figures out how to restore her honor and be worthy of him.
Yeah, actually, an interesting chapter. I actually wondered when we were reading it. Apart from Avienda's continued lessons that she's just not getting, I don't see the point of it. Really, it seems like kind of a waste of chapter to me. It's a bit insight into Avienda, one of the few points of view we get from her.
I mean, a lot of this is number one, it does give us an Avienda viewpoint. It is entirely, really, about Avienda and her great and ultimate lesson, which we will get an answer to in chapter 26. Finally, we will learn where Avienda has been failing. It also, I think, serves just a little bit to reemphasize that the Aiel who are following Rand aren't happy. I mean,
yeah.
Rand is really screwing up with them, and it's not just in the same old way that it was. I mean, that way is still there. The entire thing with Rand and the Maidens is still happening, despite repeated attempts to correct it. But it also, I mean, I think the other small part of it is just to give another nudge at Rand, another thing that happens, and Rand snaps, and he comes outside, and he's raging, and he's shaking, you know, his right fist at the sky, and yelling, you know, curse you, and just the entire, and people around him are like, oh my God, what are we doing? We're following a lunatic. There's an interesting note that Encyclopedia Watt has here, which asks, you know, what's going on that would cause her weaves of, you know, air and water to smother the fire initially. You know, why didn't that work? Why did her weaves fail? What's going on there?
I don't know. I think it has to do with the same sort of that happened with the, the keepings that are failing and, you know, the weaves of the gateways that didn't want to come together properly for the Asana and some of these other things. You know, the weaves failing for the rats, you know, the people of the rats and so forth and so on. I mean, Sidar can't fail, but it is.
Yeah. I mean, there's also, we don't ever get a confirmation about this, but I mean, it was, I think, assumed at least at one point that this was another bubble of evil. You know, them being more frequent and more oddly directed now. Again, this is just weird because it also seems that, and I've kind of just noticed this now, whenever we've seen a person spontaneously just die, it always seems to be from the inside out. I mean, the man's like, oh, God, it's hot, and, you know, and then suddenly he starts, like, you know, scratching at his face, and, like, he tears at his skin, and he's already burning up inside. I mean, this is literally spontaneous human combustion, except, like, with this, you know, he dissolves into this lump of burning black stuff that just refuses to be put out. I mean, it takes a great deal of water from that particular stream, and, like, two or three people channeling in order to, like, finally pull enough water to douse it, you know, if that's what actually put it out at all.
Yeah.
You know, and it catches the building on fire, and
I know,
along with Rand and, like, everybody who's in the building, you know, Cad Swain and everybody is just like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it was pretty bizarre, I have to tell you. I guess, you know, there probably was good reason for all that happened in it, but I'm not totally convinced. It was a nice little insight into Avienda and more insight into the strangeness that is the Aiel. You know, Rand at this point in time is just still getting creepier and creepier and weirder and more unstable than ever, so
yeah,
it's a good thing that we're moving along toward his better days. What else in that chapter? Well, you know, you do the point that, you know, the person that got consumed from the inside, you know, what I call a red shirt, and they introduced only to die in a spectacular fashion. It reminds me most obviously of the fellow in Terran's, you know, quest to get the corporate key. You know, they're in the manufactory and the guy basically turns, you know, gets eaten from the inside out by all these borer beetles, you know. He basically just becomes an empty skin after they, you know, exude from his body, you know, like in the mummy, you know, or the...
Yeah. Well, and again, it's another one.
It also kind of reminds me of when Samael sent the messenger to Rand in Camelin, and the guy basically just, you know, spontaneously starts bleeding out on the ground, you know.
Yeah. I mean, and there are, like, it's really weird that we get all of these extremely gruesome and very similar inside-out deaths. You know, it's just, I don't know if that's supposed to be indicative of, you know, the Dark One or, you know, the Shadow, that it's not just a thing that acts from the outside, it's also something that consumes from within.
I don't know, it's pretty scary though. I particularly find those really gruesome deaths, you know, uncomfortable. Glad that those shoes are over. I mean, it's fascinating in a grotesque sort of way, but, just as soon not know about those, actually. They're creepy.
Well, I think that's going to wrap up this episode. If you would like to get a hold of us and give us any feedback, crazy theories, ideas, if you think we've missed something or you really liked, you know, something that we brought up that you hadn't thought about, you can get a hold of us in a number of ways. You can, of course, call and leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
And you can also reach us by email at podcast@dragonmount.com. We generally all will monitor the emails, and we'll usually get a response fairly quickly from one or more of us.
You can also follow both the Fourth Age podcast and our host site, dragonmount.com, on Twitter.
Yep, you can also become a fan of the Fourth Age on Facebook, and also you can follow us on Twitter at Fourth Age.
In addition, on our host site, dragonmount.com, there are, of course, the forums for the Fourth Age, which you can get to by going to www.dragonmount.com/forums. In addition to that, we also have a comments section after each individual podcast. So don't be afraid to stop into either of those, even and especially the forum, and you can feel free at any given time to give us any feedback through those, because we are often in and looking at those and are more than willing to continue any of the varied conversations our podcast brings up on the online community with everyone.
Yep. We love it. Anyway, I think that will pretty much wrap up this podcast. We'll be back again in the next episode to continue on with our Gathering Storm review, which we hope this time will actually get done and published before Towers of the Night is published. So, in the meantime, this is Virginia saying, may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And for myself, Andrew Gellis, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Seraphian Entomon Shima, Dai Shite.
Marriage is what brings us together today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time broadcast.
There it comes back again from the dead, the broadcast.
This chapter begins from Elaine's point of view. The two of them, great. You gave me an Elaine chapter. Thank you. So, we gave them all the ways they could reach us. Now we just gotta say goodbye. Now it's time to say goodbye. M-I-C.
To all our friends and kin, M-Y-N-Y-D-D-S-E-R-E-N.
Yeah, right.
Aes Sedai. We think that we know far too much.
We're not the servants of anybody. We run things the way we want. A-I-A-E-S-S-C-D-A-I-A-I-A.
Thank you, and good night.
And for myself, Andrew Gellis, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, I like chicken.